Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you're with us in this second half hour of the program. Let me mention that tomorrow, Wednesday for Politics Day, I'll be joined by political scientist Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Also, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa. So much happening on the political landscape to pick apart tomorrow. But also this half hour, my guest this half hour is Nicholas Gvozdev. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Many credentials here. It would take a long time to go through all of them. I'll just say he's the author of six books, many articles, frequent commentator on U.S. foreign policy and international relations, Russia, Eurasian affairs, developments in the Middle East. Nicholas Gvozdev joins us from Newport, Rhode Island, the U.S. Naval War College. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to mention that you'll be speaking next week before the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. That's next Tuesday, September 17th at 5:30. And the title of your talk, The Role and Scope of U.S. Global Engagement. Let me ask you about the news that just broke within the last hour. President Trump announcing that he has fired John Bolton, his third national security advisor. He informed I guess John Bolton was informed, as many in his administration have been before him, via Twitter. Here's the tweet. I informed John Bolton last night that his services are no longer needed at the White House. I disagreed strongly with many of his suggestions, as did others in the administration. I therefore asked John for his resignation, which he has given to me this morning. Thank you very much for your I thank John very much for his service. So tell us, what does this tell you about the direction of foreign policy and national security in this administration?
Well, let me give you my own personal assessment of that, so I'm certainly not speaking on behalf of the Navy or of the college in any of these comments. It reflects the fact that there has always been an essential tension between the person of Donald Trump, his instincts on foreign policy, and the Washington environment and the Republican Party environment into which he has emerged. So the president ran as a candidate against many aspects of America's role in the world. He was known for questioning the value of alliances. He was questioning the efficacy of the use of American power in the Middle East, certainly in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was questioning the value of the United States linking together different parts of the world in free trade and security arrangements. And he got to Washington and he came up against a foreign policy establishment that is still committed to America playing an outsized role in the world. Certainly there are differences. Mr. Bolton obviously came from a more hawkish and unilateral part of the U.S. foreign policy establishment that shared with the president a sense that maybe alliances are not useful, that international organizations limit America's freedom of action. So there was some commonalities with Trump's instincts. But at the same time, even John Bolton remains committed and remain committed to a vision of America's role in the world, which is very much about forward engagement, about projecting American power outward into the rest of the international arena. And I think that the president, it seemingly is returning to some of his campaign roots as we near the 2020 elections, and I think is looking to wrap up some of America's overseas involvements. And that brought him into conflict, certainly, as we've seen, not just simply with John Bolton. It brought him into conflict with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis. It brought him into conflict with then-Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. We've seen a good deal of churn in the national security establishment, in part because Trump, either by choice or design, has not found people who share some of his instincts in foreign policy to populate the senior positions within the national security establishment. So this tension remains there, and today is the latest iteration with the news of John Bolton's departure, that this tension remains unresolved.
Mm-hmm. And I think this really fits in with a project that you supervised for the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, recently a project, and you said just a moment ago, the outsized or oversized role of the U.S. in the rest of the world. The interim report, I believe, was titled Misconnecting with the U.S. Public, Narrative Collapse and U.S. Foreign Policy. Is that what you're, President Trump's, as a candidate, ran on getting us out of a lot of the world, and you're saying this, in this report, does it match up with a lot of what we're hearing from the public?
Well, what we've seen over the last number of years, this certainly predates the 2016 campaign, is that prior to 2016, the Obama administration, and particularly its political advisors, were struggling with this disconnect, that the U.S. population was not necessarily committed to the U.S. playing a major role in the world if they did not see what those benefits of that role were. And we have to go back and see the impact of things like the way that the Iraq and Afghan wars have turned out, the impact of the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. All of these things really challenged, in many segments of the U.S., the sense that, is the country on the right track? Is American foreign policy designed to serve to make Americans feel more prosperous and safe? And by 2016, you had, at least in Republican primaries and in a number of key states, people saying, we don't feel safer or more prosperous because the U.S. has been playing this major role in maintaining the so-called international liberal order. We don't see the benefits, and in fact, we see costs that we're paying. Trump certainly ran on this, but to an extent, also Bernie Sanders, in his insurgency in the Democratic primaries, was also questioning some of the verities that the Washington foreign policy community for the last 30 years has treated as an unchallengeable orthodoxy, that America must be the indispensable nation, it must be the indispensable superpower, and Americans must bear the burdens of global leadership for the sake of the world order. And I think you've had American voters questioning that and feeling this disconnect. And what we're seeing now, very interestingly, in the run-up to the 2020 campaign, and as I said, I believe that the departure of John Bolton is connected to the president's to President Trump's attempts to reconnect to that base in 2016 that has questioned whether or not he has remained true to some of his campaign promises. But we're also seeing in the Democratic primaries, where the bipartisan orthodoxy of the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations is being questioned by a number of the candidates who are seeking to become the standard bearer in 2020. And what you're seeing there is people saying, we need to revisit these bargains. We need to revisit America's role in the world, what America should be prepared to do, what we should ask friends and allies to do. And particularly, I think, among the Democrats, this is coming out in two areas. One is the question of trade and jobs, but it's also coming out in discussions about climate change and the types of policies that we need to enact.
Nicholas Gvozdev is my guest, professor of national security at the U.S. Naval War College. He'll be speaking in Des Moines next week. Let's talk specifically about the news on Afghanistan. We're talking in a week in which the president said negotiations with the militant group, with the Taliban, are dead. Trump scrapping the talks with the Taliban, planned for these secret talks, evidently planned for Camp David over the weekend, ostensibly because an American soldier was killed by a suicide bomber last week. What are your thoughts on where this administration is after months of U.S. negotiations with the Taliban militants?
I think we're struggling with the fact that there are no good options in Afghanistan, and this is a political problem that we face, because in our own domestic political discourse, we're always talking about optimal options and success. And when we look at Afghanistan, we are realizing that after 18 years of operations there, we are not able to point to successes as we defined them. We went in with very expansive goals in 2001 and 2002. It wasn't simply about rooting out the Al-Qaeda infrastructure that had enabled the 9/11 attacks to take place. We were going to reconstruct Afghanistan. We were going to modernize it. We were going to push it on the road to democracy. And there was even a bit of hubris that we would show that America could succeed where Britain and then the Soviet Union had failed. Having laid out those types of objectives, though, we are discovering that the American population was not committed to victory in Afghanistan at all costs. Certainly, it's not a winning thing to go out and say we need to be paying higher taxes for Afghanistan or we need to reinstitute the draft for Afghanistan. And I think one of the things we saw with this administration, with the current administration, which not only myself, but interestingly enough, some of my students at the War College were picked up on very early in looking at how the president reluctantly agreed to Secretary Mattis's proposals for increases in Afghanistan. The tendency we have of assuming that we can make major changes with very minimal investments of force and aid, that somehow we could really turn Afghanistan around. And now we're faced with a series of unpleasant trade-offs. And again, this is something that not only the president, not only President Trump, but also that the Democratic candidates that are aspiring to succeed him next year. What's the calculus? What will be the trade-off in terms of do we stay in Afghanistan in perpetuity? And if we stay in Afghanistan, where are we not therefore deploying in other parts of the world? Or if we stay in Afghanistan, at what level? How many casualties are acceptable? If we decide to leave, what happens? For example, we're going to, you know, one of the things that was interesting about these talks that the special envoy Zalmay Khalilzad was conducting secretly for the last number of months. Is this question of, well, what happens to things like women's rights in Afghanistan? Because some of the deals that are on the table in certain areas of Afghanistan, the advances that Afghan women have made would be protected because they would be in the north or in Kabul. But, the proposed peace deals look at a decentralized Afghanistan, which would put significant parts of the Pashtun countryside back under the control of the Taliban, and they might be a bit more gentle in how they choose to enforce a very extreme version of Islamic law, but it would not recognize women as having equal rights. Is that a trade-off that Americans are willing to accept, that we would say we're willing, after 18 years of trying to modernize Afghanistan, that we're going to write these things off? So there's a lot of trade-offs at play. And the thing that worries me is I still have not heard much of a debate, not within the administration and not within Congress, that begins to set out what the priorities are and where we should accept risk and what less than optimal outcomes should we be willing to accept if it means that we can extricate U.S. forces from Afghanistan. And I think the president seems to have wanted to put the cart before the horse, as he's also done with North Korea, with Kim Jong-un, which is have meetings first and then sort these things out afterwards. But sooner or later, that is a conversation that we need to have about what it is we want with Afghanistan and how much longer we are committed to maintaining the current course of the intervention.
7 or 8 minutes left with Nicholas Gvozdev, National Security Affairs Scholar at the U.S. Naval War College in Rhode Island. Let me ask you about the other news that just broke. For decades, the CIA had an informant in the Russian government who eventually gained access, according to reports, to the highest levels of the Kremlin. This person was instrumental to the agency's conclusion that the Russian president orchestrated Russia's interference in the U.S. election in 2016. This source, the CIA spy, was extracted from Russia. What are your thoughts on this spy, and how many spies of this caliber may we have in Russia? And we have to mention here, you are a Russian American, right?
Yes, great grandparents from Russia.
Okay, good. Not pretty tenuous tie, but let's go back to the CIA spy.
Well, I mean, I think that this reminds people that even in the 21st century, we still operate by time-honored principles of human espionage. This would not have been out of place 100 years ago or 2,000 years ago. Ultimately, we want to know what goes on in other governments, and electronic monitoring gets you so far. And of course, after 2013, the Russians got a lot more wise to how the United States intercepts electronic messages. And there are, of course, stories that Putin never uses email, doesn't touch cell phones, is very much a old-fashioned face-to-face pen and paper sort of person. And so if you want to get a sense of what he's up to, by the way, not just with him, but, you know, even with friends and allies. This was a minor scandal during the Obama years when Angela Merkel, to her chagrin, discovered that the United States was trying to intercept her communications. Yes. We want to know what others are thinking. And the Godfather's credo is, you know, sometimes you even hold your friends even closer. Keep your enemies close, but your friends closer. And so it doesn't surprise me that, given that the Russian political system is opaque, given that it does not, unlike the U.S., it is not a system where people daily broadcast what they're doing. It does not have the same culture of leaking as we do in Washington, where it's impossible to keep secrets, that we would want to try to recruit people in the presidential administration and elsewhere in the Russian government to get a sense. What is surprising to me, based upon what I've read in the CNN report and in the New York Times, is the sense that the belief that this asset was vulnerable to being discovered precisely because there was worries that the administration would not safeguard or take the basic steps to safeguard his identity, and that sooner or later the Russians might figure out that they had a leak inside their system. But again, it's a reminder that this is part of the realities of statecraft. And again, other countries are also trying to do it to us as well. So it is part of that cloak and dagger world. What the Russians do now, obviously, it's an embarrassment, so it's not surprising that you have senior Russian officials saying, we don't know who this person is, he never worked here, I have no idea who they're talking about, because it is it's embarrassing when you have a senior figure, because the Russian presidential administration, this would be equivalent to someone working in the office of the White House, so someone who would be directly on the on the presidential staff. It'd be like as if one of the president's senior counselors or his press secretary were working for a foreign power. So it's that level of embarrassment, and also that level, not necessarily of technical secrets, but just conveying thinking. What were Putin and his inner circle thinking and doing, and how were they approaching policy? And I'm sure that if that's what was being reported, it was very useful both to the Obama and then to the Trump administration to get a handle on on thinking inside the Kremlin.
In the final couple of minutes, let me get your reflections on 9/11, since we have that anniversary tomorrow, 18 years since the tragedy on 9/11. I don't know, where were you on 9/11? What were your immediate thoughts?
I was actually working in Washington, D.C. in an office that was four blocks from the White House. And one of the things that has always struck me about that is really what they call the fog of war, or the confusion that breaks out, because to first be in an office and to watch the first strike on the Twin Towers, and it wasn't clear what it was this pilot error, had a plane gone off course, then to have the monitors on and to see the second plane strike and to realize that this is not an accident. And then, of course, in Washington at the time, you have the strike on the Pentagon later that morning, but there was also there were reports that there were car bombs at the State Department and that there were potential attacks elsewhere. And we were, as I said, a few blocks from the White House, just down on 16th Street, and you had people fleeing. You had people evacuating. Offices were closing. There was this sense of panic, of not knowing what was happening. And then in the immediate aftermath, once it became clear that there were no, after the crash of Flight 93, that there were no further hijacked aircraft, but to have the National Guard deployed on the streets of Washington, to armored personnel carriers, right? So things that you don't associate with the capital of the free world. It's something that happens to other countries.
Right.
That was the idea that, wait a minute, the United States may not be so exceptional after all, that what happens in other parts of the world can happen here.
In the final minute, I wonder, as a national security affairs expert, have you ever pondered, I have to believe you have, what would be the national security implications had we reacted differently to 9/11?
Oh, of course. There are so many counterfactuals. If we had had a more limited mission, people forget that for the 3 to 4 months after 9/11, there was unprecedented unanimity among all of the major powers of the world that Al-Qaeda was a threat and that this needed to be dealt with. NATO, for the first time, invokes Article 5, the first time in NATO's history, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization saying this is an attack. You had so much opportunity for creating a true international coalition and to do that, and to see how we essentially turned our back on some of that help, said we don't want it, we don't want the restrictions, and then, of course, the great what-if of turning away from Afghanistan too soon and going into Iraq in 2003. I think that's what future historians will look back. They will see the missed opportunities after 9/11 for really charting a different course. And then, of course, these wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, and others, leaving legacies that the United States is going to be dealing with for decades to come.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have your insights this half hour. Nicholas Gvozdev, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. He'll be speaking next week before the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations next Tuesday at 5:30 in the evening. The title of his talk, The Role and Scope of U.S. Global Engagement. Thanks again to Nicholas Gvozdev.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez, with help from Stephanie Nobrega. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Reminder again, Politics Wednesday tomorrow. Hope you'll join us. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Until tomorrow.